KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. When this show is being recorded, at the beginning of June. However, when you hear the show, I will be an assistant professor at the new Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society. So always want to make sure that the people actually hearing the show, when they hear it, know where I am as opposed to when I'm recording the show. I'm very excited today to have on the show a guest who's going to be talking about some topics that we haven't touched on closely on this show before. Larry Downes, among other things, is a professor at UC Berkeley. But interestingly, he is an author who, while writing extensively in the business market generally with his book, The Strategy Machine, Building Your Business One Idea at a Time. Larry's also a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society, and I decided to invite Larry on the show after actually reading a blog entry that he wrote on the CIS webpage under his blog. And the title of the entry is "The Revolution Will Be Televised on YouTube." And I kind of jumped into it because what I saw Larry writing about was a topic that I'm particularly interested in, which is comparing the revolution that exists today with respect to technology and Web 2.0 and the read-write culture that Larry Lessig and others have written about with the past, particularly the Industrial Revolution. And in Larry's blog posting, which you can find on cyberlaw.stanford.edu, you will see that he draws a comparison between what's happening today in terms of not only concentration of power among groups of individuals and entities, but also how information itself is produced. And it really sparked my interest in something that I was particularly excited about because I wanted to have a discussion like this on Hearsay Culture, drawing that comparison. For those that aren't familiar, my background partially is focused on labor and employment. I got my undergraduate degree at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations, and particularly was interested in labor history and labor economics, but also I've litigated labor and employment cases more recently as an assistant corporation counsel for the New York City Law Department. So labor and employment law has always been an interest of mine, but also I'm an amateur historian. So, I mean, everything comes together synergized in Larry's posting. Larry Downes has many credits to his name. By way of background, he has a BA from Northwestern University and received his JD from the University of Chicago, where he was an Olin Fellow. From 1993 to 1994, he served as a law clerk to Richard Posner, Chief Judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, a judge well known to any lawyers and many non-lawyers out there. He's a founding fellow of the Cyberspace Law Institute and a member of the Bar of California. He's written extensively for a number of publications and, in fact, is working on a new book that we'll discuss today on the show. And like I said, he's also at UC Berkeley School of Information. So without much more introduction, we're going to take another short music break. You're hearing Gonzalo Rubalcaba, for those of you who are listening live on KZSU. We're going to take that break now, and then when we come back, we'll start the discussion with Professor Larry Downes. So if I've done my job properly, at the other end of the line is Larry Downes. Larry, are you there?
I am, Dave. Thanks.
Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture to discuss your blog entry, which, like I said in the introduction, is the first time that I've invited someone on directly because of a blog entry that I've read. So I appreciate you being here today. Let's start off really with more of an introduction of who you are and how you came to write about this particular topic on your blog.
Okay. Well, I've been sort of working in both business and law for many years and moving more towards the law side of things, but always in the area of information technology. That's where I sort of started my work career and my education and research work as well. And, I've written a couple books about business innovation, but I always noticed in the literature, even my own books, that there was very, very little ever said about the impact of law and regulation on either development or execution of a business strategy. And this led me to wonder, well, you know, what is the impact? And the more I looked at it, the more I realized the impact is very, very large and very poorly understood. And particularly in times of great technological change, it can be quite decisive in terms of who wins and who loses and how things actually play out.
The school that you teach in at Berkeley is one I've had, as you know, I've had a number of guests on the show from Berkeley, including Paul Duguid and Henry Chesbrough will be on later this year or during the summer discussing his book. By way of background on the school, you don't hear a lot of schools called the School of Information, and I'm curious, or for information, just a very top level, what is the focus of the school itself?
It's a very interesting program. It was started about 10 years ago. The first dean, Hal Varian, who is well known, I'm sure, to many of your listeners, an economist and a business professor, and he had the idea that there was a real lack of appreciation for how information and information economics in particular were understood in the business environment. So the School of Information is a graduate program. About 80 master students, and most of them come from engineering backgrounds. They may have been working in industry for a while, and they realize, you know, essentially programming is sort of a dead-end career track. They want to move more into management or into user design or user interface testing. And so this program is essentially a way of them getting kind of a mini MBA as well as updates of their technical and user credentials, and then they go back into industry, in many cases very, very successfully.
Information flow and how information is disseminated, I think, even now, is becoming more and more of a topic that people focus on, as opposed to how people stereotypically viewed library science and things like that as kind of dry, boring stuff. And I think the distribution of information is something that you know, we get into immediately, and we should dive right into because it's many ways at the core of your blog entry. For those people that haven't seen the entry, perhaps it would be best to start off with kind of a summary of the points that you were making in that posting.
Well, I should probably start by saying how it came to be written.
Or even better.
I was doing some work for a very large technology company in Europe, and I had just sort of arrived, you know, overnight flight, jet lagged, very confused, but I went in to see them anyway, and I was just sort of talking in the hallway with one of their engineers, and he was saying, "Oh, did you see, you know, the other day, you know, the Viacom filed a lawsuit against Google and YouTube for $1.5 billion in damages for copyright infringement." And this engineer said, "You know, I don't understand it. We have this great product for filtering out copyrighted content, and if they just used that product, they wouldn't have any trouble at all." And I can't figure out why they're not interested in it. And this sort of sat with me for a while. I went back to my hotel room and you know, woke up in the middle of the night, of course, because of the time difference, couldn't sleep. And I sat down and I thought, this is really the paradigmatic problem with business today, is that they don't really understand what's going on with information culture, and particularly the impact of law that has on that culture. So I sat down and I said, look, this is not about, you know, tinkering with the machinery here. It's not about a particular product that is or isn't being used. This is about a fundamental shift in the legal culture and you know, fundamental shifts in legal culture, otherwise known in historical terms as a revolution.
Hmm.
And when you have it, you know, and then I realized, you know, when you have a technological revolution, and we certainly can, I think, not have to argue about whether or not information technology has been revolutionary, particularly in the last 20 years. When you have a technological revolution, if you look back in history, you always, always have a corresponding legal revolution. Sometimes they're violent, sometimes they're not violent, but the law always goes through a dramatic transformation along with that economic transformation. And that's what got me interested in sort of, well, what really is behind that lawsuit? What really is behind the difference between people like my client, who see it in engineering terms, and people, you know, let's say, for convenience, under the age of 30, who see something much, much more fundamental, that's social, cultural, political, as well as technological.
The let's jump into it, I guess, with kind of something that I had Richard Epstein on the show, and he was pointing out that generally we don't view intellectual property rights, or we don't view technological change as being enforced by way of violence. And the violent aspect of revolutions is something that, you know, perhaps we can explore a little bit by asking you. You talk a bit about the information revolution itself as compared to, as you put it, it are not industrial, they are bits. They are bloody fights, not over natural resources and access to emerging markets, but over use and ownership of ideas. How, at the top level, how do you draw the comparison between what happened 100 years ago, which starts us at that point, to today?
Well, the comparisons, I think, are pretty compelling in terms of looking for differences is also looking for the similarities. So you had, in the Industrial Revolution, you had a pretty traumatic transformation. Essentially, the world, at least the developing world, moved from kind of a feudal legal structure to a property rights legal structure. And, in some cases, let's say in the United States, there were moments when it looked like that revolution might be violent, and some historians would say the Civil War was in some sense about that transformation. So it was, and of course that has been the most bloody war that the United States has ever been involved in. But later, in the later part of the 19th century, with the progressive movement, you had something, that was much less violent, although still quite radical in its thinking. But then overseas, you had very violent revolutions. Certainly, I think of the Russian Revolution. You know, this was by definition a revolution over the control of the means of production, as Marx had said. And you saw, that transformation take place over a very long period of time, but with tremendous amount of chaos and instability, some of which spilled over elsewise into to Europe. Now, today, there's the same kind of driving forces, which is that you have a technological change that's creating vast amounts of new wealth and new value and changing the way in which, economic behavior happens. And invariably, you're going to have people struggling over who gets to control and who gets to exploit that new value and new information. And just as it did 100 years ago, the starting point is with reference to, well, what is the existing legal infrastructure that defines or maybe tries to define who does and doesn't have that control?
The legal structure that we're talking about today, of course, is one where we see an increasing tension between those that want to sharply control the use of their property and those that seek to engage in other forms of creation that include, just to put it simply, sharing.
Sharing, and, collaboration, and yeah.
Exactly. And in that way, do you see, or put it another way, is there a traceable history of that kind of collaboration in the Industrial Revolutions that people, that everyone who, at least in a U.S. school that studied history, would have looked at as a kid?
I don't think so. And I think we should probably step half a step back and say, when we talk about this being a struggle over property, we should, start by noting that intellectual property is not like physical property in so many fundamental ways. And in some sense, intellectual property is a legal fiction. It didn't exist without the passage of patent and trademark and copyright and trade secret law in the U.S., but also in other countries. And without those laws, there wouldn't be such a thing as intellectual property. And it's a fiction that, as I've argued recently in some articles, is a fiction that has really over time lost more and more of its value as a metaphor, as a way of thinking about ideas, as a way of thinking about information, to the point now where I think you could safely say the fiction has really disappeared. It's lost its meaning. Thinking about ideas, thinking about creations of the mind as property, is just no longer particularly useful either as a philosophical starting point, but more importantly, it's not particularly useful as a legal framework.
The property debate itself, again, these are great answers, not only because they're interesting, but because they segue nicely into the kinds of questions I want to ask. So thank you. The property debate is another major battleground today, and of course, there, as you just said, there are people that view the name intellectual property as a misnomer right there, and Richard Stallman famously has made that point numerous times, and many other people have as well. But yet we're dealing with a history that does focus heavily and has to focus heavily on ownership and the ability to exclude. And the ability to exclude as going all the way back to the Commons of England and the poor laws and all of the economic laws that existed in the 19th century. And I'm not going to go so far back now that the Hearsay Culture Show that focuses on long technology talks about sheep grazing in the meadow in 1820. But we have the issue of exclusivity, of the ability to exclude, running throughout our history. And do you see that topic itself, as opposed to property, but the right to exclude, is something that fits in both in the past and in today's paradigm as you view it?
Well, I think the answer is mostly yes, although certainly it's been pointed out to me, correctly so, that you know many Native cultures, particularly Native American cultures, didn't even understand the idea of exclusivity when it came to physical property, the idea that somebody owned land was like, you know, they owned God or they owned the sky. They just didn't mean anything to those cultures. So even in some sense, physical property is a fiction, but it's certainly true that it's very, very different with information because it can't be excluded except by extremely unnatural behavior, and that's the main difference between, let's say, a barrel of oil and an idea. You have a barrel of oil, it means I've got it, you don't have it. When I use it, it's gone. So excluding it is something that you can think about rationally. But if I have an idea, the idea that, you know, the idea of that idea is one that just can't be easily excluded, and to do so limits its usefulness, limits its potential for improvement. That's what ideas do. They get better over time. Isaac Newton famously said, if I've seen further than others, it's only because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. And if you don't share ideas, if you don't collaborate on ideas, if you exclude too many people from ideas, they're not particularly useful at all. Whereas the more you let them be shared and the more you let people collaborate, the more valuable they become. That's such a fundamentally different way of thinking about use than you would for physical property. As I say, that's really where the fiction breaks down.
The comparison to the Industrial Revolution is one that brings to mind the gears of technology in a very different way. And we think about people like Frederick Taylor and others that set human beings in a particular mode, or the assembly line generally, where the human being, rather than creating from start to finish, is merely doing the job number 28 of tightening a bolt or what have you. And today, of course, when we talk about the read-write culture and we talk about the idea of someone being able to take a previously created work, mash it up, change it, what have you, have the technology available to them at home to do that work and then disseminate it, we're dealing with almost the entire chain of production that human beings simply didn't have access to, in at least in the technological sense, not too long ago. And so the role of human beings in the technology is another area which I know you're interested in. And again, with that background, the top level question being, what lessons or things can we draw from that history to today?
Well, that I think is what makes the information revolution revolutionary. It was easy in some sense to exclude people from information when the cost of production and distribution was so high. So imagine, pre-Gutenberg, the cost of copying a manuscript, which of course now I can do almost without thinking at a cost of unmeasurably small, the cost of reproducing a manuscript was enormously high. It had to be done by hand. You had to have access to the original manuscript. It was incredibly time-consuming. It required very specialized skills and abilities by the copyist and so on. And in some ways, that was really not the law, but the fact that cost was so high for breaking the law is really what made the fiction of excluding people from information work at all. Now, as you follow the information revolution, and it gets cheaper and cheaper and easier to get access to copy, to mash up, to reproduce, to collaborate, to improve on existing information, that's where the revolutionary activity really starts to happen. You just can't exclude people when the cost of enforcement is now sort of gone the opposite direction. What used to be cost of copying was incredibly high. Now the cost of enforcement is what's become incredibly high. And not surprisingly, the result is pretty predictable. When the costs are high, the activity goes down. In this case, the cost of enforcement is becoming astronomical, and therefore enforcement won't happen.
You peg 1955 in your blog post as the beginning of the information revolution. And yes. I think it would be helpful for listeners for you to explain what's significant about that year.
Sure, and I'm glad you're asking now, because I've just updated some of this mathematical data that I'm going to give you.
Okay.
1955 was the sale of the first commercial computer. There had been government computers before, but in 1955, the UNIVAC 1 was sold to General Electric as a commercial computer. It was used, in fact, for a payroll application. That's the beginnings of commercial computing that we've got. And so I say, if you think about commercial computing as starting in 1955, it's very helpful as a way of thinking about just how far the technology has come, because oftentimes when we're, you know, in the midst of a revolution, we don't really see it. So here's a way to think about it. In 1955, if you bought a UNIVAC 1 in 1955, and you, let's call that a 1 in terms of how much computing you could do with it, roughly speaking, if you wanted to do the same math today, and let's say instead of talking about commercial computing, we're going to talk about toy computing. So we're going to talk about, when I first did this calculation, the most innovative toy computer, which you bought in a toy store, was the PlayStation 2. And what I worked out was that the equivalent of PlayStation 2 would be about 22 million UNIVAC 1s.
Wow.
22 million. And that's what we were selling to kids.
Huh.
And just to get a sense of that, if you had, in fact, bought 22 million UNIVAC 1s in 1955, first of all, just to store them, you would need a space that's roughly equivalent to the size of the city of Seattle, Washington. And the cost in 1955 dollars would have been about the equivalent of the GDP of the United States in 2000.
Amazing.
Now, I say I just forwarded up this information, so now I've updated it. Now we're talking about the PlayStation 3, which you can buy today at the toy store. That would be the equivalent, just in the few years between those two models. Now, instead of 22 million UNIVACs, we're talking about 660 million UNIVAC 1s.
Huh.
Okay, the storage space for 660 million UNIVAC 1s is the state of Washington. And the cost of 660 million UNIVAC 1s in 1955 dollars is more than the entire monetary supply of the world today.
That's quite a comparison.
So that's what's happened since 1955, you know, roughly 50 years of computing. And you get in a toy now the equivalent of computing that would fit in the state of Washington in 1955. Unbelievable ability. You know, of course, it's driven by some very interesting physics and some very interesting developments in semiconductor technology in particular, but it's revolutionary. There's no question that this is not the kind of thing that you can talk about in terms of, you know, tinkering with the machinery either of economic thinking or, in this case particularly, of legal thinking.
The comparison is striking, and you know, although I could think of whether maybe you stack the UNIVACs up maybe by a factor of 20, and then it's maybe a third of the state of Washington, but that isn't really the focus of the show. I'll save spatial relations for another discussion. But it begs the question of what we're doing with this computing power today that we weren't doing before. And I mean, and in some ways, the answer, of course, is obvious with virtual gaming and the computations that computers can do. But I guess the larger question is, as this development has occurred over the last 50-odd years, as you identify it, do you think that the designers, the people doing this development, envisioned the kind of computing power that would exist for things like gaming? Where do you think, you know, the transition, if you have a sense of it, went from the purely computational uses of the military and of businesses that we can trace back to the beginning of computing to today?
Well, you know, obviously there were some tremendous visionaries, Gordon Moore of Intel and Hewlett and Packard and some others. But, you know, by and large, of course, this has all been happy accidents. Certainly nobody back in 1955 thought, yeah, if we work really hard on this, you know, in 50 years, kids will be able to, you know, virtually assassinate each other with ultra-modern weapons.
On what a shame.
Spoon that's, you know, so believable that you get motion sickness if you stare at it too
right.
long. Most of that's happened by accidents and coincidence, and that's really the way capitalism works. That's one of the wonderful things about capitalism is when there's a technology, it finds its own market, and the right people happen to be at the right place at the right time, not because they were brilliant visionaries who saw 10, 20, even 30 years into the future, but just because they happened to pick the right application and do so in the right market at the right time. I don't think much of what we're doing today with computers was foreseen or planned or even imagined. We don't have to go back 50 years, say 20 years ago, nobody would have really predicted seriously a lot of the things that we now take completely for granted today. And of course, the nice thing about Moore's law is that no real sign of it ending. So we can continue to expect to see our computers get faster and cheaper and smaller all the time. I just was helping a friend. She had an iPod that you know, had 10 hours of music and thought that would be satisfactory. And then after a few months, she said, "Oh, the heck with this! I'm going to get one that's 10 times more capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went the other day and bought a GPS navigation system at Costco for $200 that I'm sure, you know, any military commander during the Korean War, the Vietnamese War, would have killed to have this kind of technology, which I can now pick up at Costco.
The role of serendipity, of happenstance, is really another fascinating area. It's almost a game theory type discussion that I'll save for another day. But I think it's a good way to actually stop here and take a short music break and then kind of segue into discussion of the book that you're working on now after the music break. So you're listening to Hearsay Culture and KZSU-FM. Dave Levine in discussion with Professor Larry Downs from UC Berkeley. We're going to take the short music break right now and then return and continue the discussion on KZSU. Before we continue the discussion with Professor Larry Downs, now is a time on Hearsay Culture where I beg you for money for KZSU. KZSU is a non-commercial, non-profit radio station here at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners to continue its wide-ranging programming. In order to survive, it requires people to contact KZSU and say, I'd like to give you some money. So how can you do that? You have two options. You can go to the webpage for KZSU at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Or alternatively, you can go to the internet and simply dial up, to use an old phrase, your email and email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, please continue to keep listening to KZSU. So we're back with Larry Downs. And Larry, before the break, I mentioned that you have started, or you are in the process of working on your next book. Why don't we just top level, what's that book about?
Well, essentially, it's many of the topics we've been discussing already, Dave. It's a book on what I think about as the interaction between law and technology, it's a very accident-prone intersection, and in particular, of course, I'm talking about the revolutionary technology of the last 50 years, particularly the last 20 years in information, and just how it's destroying and eventually rebuilding the legal structure that goes with it.
We're back to the topic of destruction. And how does what is the focus of destruction in what you're writing about today?
Well, I go back here, of course, I also, like Newton, although not as successfully, stand on the shoulders of giants. I really like the formulation of Joseph Schumpeter, the great economist of the 19th century. He described capitalism as a series of creative destructions. This is a phrase that became famous, although misunderstood, during the 1999-2000 boom. What he meant was that the way capitalism works is not in a sort of linear, progressive, nice, easy, calculatable way, but that when there are revolutionary technologies, business goes through pretty significant convulsions. Industries die, industries are born, businesses die, new businesses are born. And he said, that's fine. It's all, you know, it's all creative. That's what makes capitalism so successful. But there is a lot of destruction involved, destruction and then ultimately recreation or resurrection into new forms, and you know, the assets get recollected into new kinds of institutions or new kinds of enterprises. And that's what I think happens as well, trailing, but also happens in terms of law. So, again, when we had the Industrial Revolution, very slowly but over time, a whole very complicated and really outdated system of feudal law and feudal law structures gave way to what we now think of as our current basis for legal thinking, which is a more of a property rights regime. And as I will argue in the book, property rights now is, again, no longer a particularly useful metaphor, no longer a particularly useful set of structures. We will have and continue to have large-scale legal revolution. Again, slowly and in some ways in very unpredictable ways it's going to play out. But ultimately we will have a new legal system, a new legal infrastructure, much as we did at the end of the Industrial Revolution.
What metaphor would you identify as more appropriate today for the culture that we live in?
I think of it more, again, as a collaborative culture. That's really the nature of information. It's more about how you add value to existing information and make it useful for other people in new forms and in new ways by mashing things up, bringing things together, collaborating. So I think of it essentially, instead of a property regime, think of it more as an open source or a collaborative regime. That's sort of the, I think, the basic metaphor about around which we're going to build this new set of legal institutions.
The another phrase which is pretty well known among people looking at technology is the idea of disruptive technologies.
Yeah.
How much of what you're writing about and how much of that concept ties into your conception of where we are today?
Well, I think exclusively in some sense. Disruptive technology, this is a term that really comes from the work of Professor Clayton Christensen at the Harvard Business School, particularly in his book about innovation, The Innovator's Dilemma. And he described, and it really, this also echoes back to Schumpeter comes a lot of ties to an early book that I wrote in 1998 called Unleashing the Killer App, where I said, you know, when technology is changing as quickly as it is, really the ability of businesses or the business ability of individuals or even social structures to fully absorb the potential of those disruptive technologies is pretty limited. You know, we can only evolve so fast even when our technology is evolving faster. And in that sort of gap between the potential of new technology and really the limited ability of human beings and institutions to take full advantage of it over time, you get this great opportunity for chaos, for disruption, all these things that both Professor Christensen and Joseph Schumpeter talked about as ways in which capitalism works. So I think it's all about disruptive technologies. That's where the fun is. That's really what's disrupting the legal system as well as the business environment. And frankly, from the standpoint of my work as a business consultant, that's really where the biggest opportunities are for my client.
The utilization of one's property is another area that is getting increasing attention. Your colleague Henry Chesbrough, as I'm sure you know, has written about these issues, and in his new book, Open Business Models, he points out how few patents in many companies are actually being used. And I don't have the data in front of me, but he talks about situations where companies are literally utilizing in the market 10% of the patentable inventions that they have, and 10% indeed of the patents that they own. And again, drawing these comparisons to the past, we don't think, at least I don't, but I could be dead wrong about this, we don't think of the industrialists of the past as inventing and creating devices that then sit on the shelf with no commercial use. But indeed, it seems that companies are coming to the realization, it was brought to the head, I think, by the book Rembrandt's in the Attic, that they have these ideas and inventions which are not being used, and therefore the intellectual property regime is not serving any purpose that's useful to the public when one can get the limited monopoly of a patent by way of example, but not use that invention for public good. How much of that kind of phenomena that's getting increasing attention today do we find in the past, in the history that you've examined?
Well, probably a lot less. And one of the reasons is, and I think this is where I would part company with Hank, is one of the reasons that 90% of the patents may not be getting used, if that number is accurate, is that probably 90% of the patents are no good in the first place, that they should never have been issued, they wouldn't stand up to court challenge, they're really completely bad patents. And this is, of course, part of the problem that I'm dealing with in the new book, is that the patent system in particular is even more broken than the copyright system, for a whole list of complicated reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I think part of the answer is that in the early days of the Industrial Revolution, there weren't there weren't anywhere near the number of bad patents, and therefore you didn't have as much stuff sitting on the shelf. But part of it does go back to what I mentioned a moment ago, Professor Christensen's idea of disruptive technologies and mm-hmm. what he called the innovator's dilemma. You come up with an innovation, but in fact it's much too disruptive to your current customers, to your current way of doing business, for you to actually be the one to benefit from it. And you get lots and lots of examples, and again, from Schumpeter's standpoint, very good examples of inventions that were not, in fact, exploited by the inventors, but ultimately, found their way, maybe with some delays because of the misalignment of legal incentives in the patent system or the copyright system, but ultimately, they make their way into the market, and the creative destruction of capitalism works, and the really good ideas ultimately do find their full implementation in products and services, even if those don't happen to be done by the people who invented them in the first place.
The patent system, which we have discussed on the show and with various people, is obviously in need. I think obvious by anyone looking at it objectively, in need of reform. And yet we find a fair amount of reticence to change the system from a wide variety of individuals involved in it. The ability to change, the willingness to change, is something that ultimately, for historians, it needs to be accepted. The idea that we can learn from the history that we examine and try to find connections to today, so that we don't repeat mistakes, and or alternatively that we do things right that were done in the past. What in your estimation, with your new book, what is your ultimate goal for the reader? What do you hope that the reader takes away from the project that you're working on now?
Well, I mean, I particularly want the reader to understand that what these individual headlines that they sometimes see, this person is sued for $1 billion, or this article comes out about sort of some major legal challenge, or what the state of intellectual property enforcement is in China and other developing countries. I want them to understand that that whole set of headlines is part of a bigger story, and a bigger story that I don't think is adequately or accurately covered in business or trade media. And that bigger story is about fundamental, again, back to my jet lag comment to my client from my hotel room, not about a product or service. It's about a fundamental shift in the economy, and with it a fundamental shift in the legal infrastructure that is going to support that economy. So first and foremost, I want them to understand that that's happening, just as an objective, neutral matter. Now, secondly, I want them to understand that is probably a good thing that it's happening. Again, it's part of the creative destruction that makes capitalism, so this is my Chicago school orientation now coming through.
I was waiting for it.
It's why capitalism is good. Uh-huh. Revolutions are not bad things, particularly if they are handled correctly and with minimal resistance, and the violence is kept to a minimum. These revolutions are good. They generate new value. They generate increased wealth, improved lifestyles. Ultimately, we hope we can make those uniform, or as uniform as we can, across as wide a population as we can, but new value is good. And then the third thing, I suppose, and the one that's probably most important to my publishers, is to give some advice to both businesses as well as individuals about what they should do in the interim, right? So we're going to be living for some period of time. We can't really predict how long, but we'll be living through a fairly disruptive period of legal change that goes with the technological change. And what do we do about that? How do we take advantage of it? How do we help it along if we have a sort of policy orientation? How do we use it for profit if we have a business orientation? This is a lot of what I do in my consulting work, is helping companies as well as larger institutions understand, look, this is the reality that you're living in. Let's transform that from something to complain about to something we use to make money.
Let me push back in a little bit in the remaining few, about 5-6 minutes that we have. I'll save my pushback question for the end, which is a little unfair, but I'll give you opportunity to respond to it. I won't kill the mic in the middle of it. But for people that listen to the show, they know that I'm a big fan of generally the social networking and collaborative forms of production that are getting increased attention. And I've written about trade secrecy as ultimately being a completely ill fit in the world of public infrastructure. So I think my reference point is pretty clear, and so I put that out there, that the position I'm going to throw out now is not my own, but I feel compelled to ask. There are people that take the countervailing position with respect to sharing of information that basically boils down to, this is pie in the sky, kind of very hopeful, flowery views of how the world operates, but at the end of the day, collaboration is not how our best inventions, how the best ideas are going to come about. Collaboration is going to undermine the economic incentive necessary to get people to create. In other words, by sharing, you decrease the economic value because you don't control the rights, and therefore, in the long run, we're going to see less invention, less innovation, rather than more. What's your response to that?
Well, of course, when you're talking about, sure, it's hard to be definitive, but I think the answer is we'll see. It's happening anyway. I suppose is the sort of the positivist view of this is, look, whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing, the ability to enforce intellectual property rights in particular is becoming zero. And so whether you like it or not, sort of a collapse model is emerging. My belief based on my sense of history and my sense of economics, particularly information economics, is that we'll ultimately develop more value, and of course we'll have to evolve new ways of monetizing that value and collecting that value and incentivizing that value. But my religious belief is that it's going to work. It's going to be a good thing. It may be a bumpy road. It may be a bumpy road for a long time. But regardless of whether I'm right or wrong, we're down that road.
Mm-hmm. Those sentiments, I think, are reflected in those that are starting to see DRM, digital rights management, as being really a large waste of energy. Do you see or do you think that there will be alternate ways for those that want to exercise strong control over their property to do so in this new technological environment, or is it indeed simply a losing battle?
Yeah, it's an arms race, and it's clear who's winning, and I think it's pretty clear who will continue to win. If you're going to try to, you know, fight change by rigidly sticking to the old regime, one that, again, relied heavily on the cost of cheating in a way that is now no longer useful to you, I think you're fighting a losing battle. Again, it may be many, many years, and you may be able to have some interim victories along the way. So, you know, Napster gets shut down, Grokster gets shut down. So in the short term, you may be victorious, although a lot of those victories turn out either to be hollow or, even worse, they turn out to be victories that a few years later you wish you had lost. And I think particularly in this context of the Betamax case, which is one I just love to come back to, so many ironies about it, but ultimately this is the case where the movie industry and the television producers try to block the very existence of videotape recorders. They lost that case at the Supreme Court ultimately.
Right.
And boy, 10 years later, if you'd said to them, "Do you wish you had won?" I doubt they would have said yes, because it turns out, of course, that because of the existence and the prolific distribution of videotape recorders, they entered into brand new markets in terms of selling tapes and renting tapes and so on, that now account for an enormous percentage of their profitability. That, of course, if they had won the Betamax case, they wouldn't have those markets,
right.
They wouldn't have those channels. And it's why it's very difficult to predict, but I think, again, it's why you need to be really careful about, you know, what you wish for when you sue, because you may get what you wished for and then turn out to be very, very sorry later.
To come back to your blog entry, "The Revolution Will Be Televised on YouTube," that you put on CIS's webpage, you quote at the end of the entry economist, lawyer, and historian Brooks Adams, who identifies as a great-grandson of John Adams and a close advisor to Roosevelt. And a quote that you... Teddy Roosevelt. The quote that you put in at the end of the blog entry, I want to read verbatim. Brooks Adams said, "There is no ancient and abstract principle of right and wrong which can safely be deduced as a guide to regulate the relations of railways and monopolies among our people." And of course, you said it's 100 years ago. "Because railways and monopolies are products of forces unknown in former times. The character of competition has changed, and the law must change to meet it or collapse. Such is my general theory." Oh, at the end of the day, is that a theory that you're endorsing in your new work?
That is my general theory as well. In fact, I would even go further than Brooks Adams, and at least in that quote, but I think in his other writings, he went further himself and said, the law isn't going to change. In fact, when faced with these new forces, when faced with revolutionary change in technology, in his case, things like railroads and telephones and things of that nature, the reality is law can't change fast enough or successfully enough to adapt. It's going to collapse. We will have creative destruction in law. And again, we've had it before. It's worked out just fine. It's a bumpy road, but it's a road we're down. And ultimately, it's going to happen, and it's going to work out fine. We'll get a new legal infrastructure that more closely matches the economic reality that these technologies have created. And it's going to be, you know, for some of us, it's going to be kind of fun along the way to see how it plays out.
the lawyers out there may be getting nervous depending on which side of the equation they might fall, but I think as an intellectual property scholar and one who's litigated, it's definitely going to be a fascinating time to see where this area of law develops. Well, I won't hold you to it, Larry, because I write as well, though I haven't written books, but to ask me when my next law review article comes out is one of almost throwing a dart. But generally, when can we look for your new book?
Now we have a whole separate discussion about
yeah, right.
the economics of the publishing industry.
Right, right. I'll say generally like a 6-month radius.
Well, if Mr. Gutenberg is compliant with us, I expect that the new book will be out toward the middle of the end of next year.
Well, I certainly look forward to seeing it, and I'll go so far as to say that I'm extremely intrigued by the topic, as you know, and I look forward to seeing your book, and I invite you to come back once the book is out to discuss it when I have something in front of me that I can read, and I very much look forward to seeing your new work.
Well, I appreciate that, Dave, and good luck with your new endeavors.
Thank you very much, Larry, and thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
My pleasure.
I want to thank again Professor Larry Downs from Berkeley's School of Information for being on the show today. It's always exciting to have authors on who are in at the point in the creative process that they can discuss new works and where they're headed. I have another interest in just how the creative process generally is, as one could gather from the show. And I'm almost tempted to start asking authors detailed questions about how they go ahead and write books. But I'll save that for English professors and writers themselves to have that discussion. I'm a writer, certainly, but I think it's a topic that I perhaps is interesting, but I'm not sure if it fits the format of Hearsay Culture. But if anyone has any different opinions, definitely let me know by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As I mentioned, this show is being recorded in the beginning of June, and I'm recording a number of shows. I've recorded a number of shows last week and the last week of May, and we'll be continuing to record shows through next week, early June, for the summer, as I'm going to be spending the summer basically sitting in a basement office reading through materials in preparation for teaching two classes in the fall, contracts and intellectual property, in my new job at Charlotte School of Law. But the show will continue, as I've mentioned, and does continue, and will continue once I'm at Charlotte. I'm very excited that the show will remain on KZSU as well as by podcast. And you can always find the show these various ways. The best way, of course, is to listen live, and I say that because if you can listen from 5 to 6, you get the benefit of the music. I'm a music fan, as I think people again could gather from those that listen to the live show, and so I encourage you to listen to KZSU live to hear the show. But if you don't have that time or that luxury or that ability, the podcast is always available with all of the conversation that is the heart of the show. And you can find the podcast by going to the iTunes webpage for CIS by typing Center for Internet Society into iTunes. You can also go to hearsayculture.com, where you can find the show, all past shows, as well as information about upcoming shows and other occasional rants that I decide to post there. And you can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. And I do encourage you to email me with any comments or questions or suggestions or things I'm doing right, things I'm doing wrong. That's really the only way that the show ultimately improves is when I get feedback. So I do encourage you to email me if you have the time and the interest, good and bad. I welcome all people that want to throw stuff my way. And finally, you can also get the show by podcast RSS feed on cyberlaw.stanford.edu, where you can find the blogs for all of the people affiliated with CIS, including Larry Downs' blog and the blog post upon which this show is based. So thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture and to KZSU. Please stay tuned for the great programming on KZSU, and I look forward to talking to you next week.